Good morning, everybody, and Happy New Year. Hi. We have no announcements this morning. We gather here today in this church to find again the courage to be ourselves, truly ourselves, to banish illusion, to find our way forward and find contentment. Let our eyes see, our ears hear, and our bodies feel the wonder that can be the truth of living. Come, let us worship together. And please take a moment to say hello or introduce yourself to the people around you this morning. In times of darkness, we stumble toward the tiny flame. In times of cold, we seek the warming fire. In times of repression, we reach for the lamp of truth. In times of loss, we pray for the comforting light. And in times of joy, we light a candle of celebration. Spirit of life, as we kindle this light, help us find what we need this day. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing our first hymn, number 90, From All the Fret and Fever of the Day. Welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. At LCUUC, we strive to surround this community with a spirit of love in everything we do. My name is Laura Levenhagen, and I'm the worship associate for this morning's service. As a welcoming congregation, we hope that everyone here today, wherever you find yourself on this life's journey, and whatever your background, will find a lasting home here. Please join us for refreshments and conversation in our social hall after the service. And while you're there, stop by the welcome table to find out more about LCUUC. Today's order of service includes announcements of upcoming church activities, and we look forward to everyone joining in. You can also get electronic information if you like and follow Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church on Facebook. We also have a website at lcuuc.org. And if you go there, you can also stay current on services and events. Please take a moment at this point and silence any electronics you may have brought with you today. And again, welcome to all here this morning. We are so pleased that you have chosen to celebrate and worship in this new year with us today.
One of the ways we care for the wider community is by contributing to local food pantries, both financially and through the collection of non-perishable food items, which we donate each month. To share today, you could bring them forward at this point and or as a child to bring them forward for you and put them in the basket up here. And then I invite the children to stay up front and enjoy a story. So today in the service, we're talking about losing things. Has anybody here lost anything? What did you lose?
Gloves.
Anybody else? Yeah?
My slipper socks under my sheets.
Oh, your slipper socks got lost in your sheets? Yeah? Oh, your toy bunny got lost? Yeah. Well, sometimes we lose things and we find them again, and sometimes we don't. This story today it's about losing something, but it's a little bit different than losing a toy bunny. And see if you can notice what gets lost in this story. It's called Now One Foot, Now the Other. So Bobby was named after his best friend, his grandfather Bob. When Bobby was just a baby, his grandfather told everyone, "Bobby will be 3 years old before he can say Grandpa, so I'm going to have him call me Bob." And Bob was the first word that Bobby said. Bob was the one who helped Bobby learn to walk. "Hold on to my hands, Bobby," his grandfather said. "Now one foot, now the other." One of the best things that Bob and Bobby did was to play with the old wooden blocks that were kept on a shelf under the front stairs. The blocks had letters on two sides, numbers on two sides, and pictures of animals and other things on the last two sides. Bob and Bobby would slowly, very slowly, put the blocks one on top of the other, building a tall tower. There were 30 blocks. Sometimes the tower would fall down when only half the blocks were piled up. Sometimes the tower was almost finished. "Just one more block," Bob would say. "And that's the elephant block," Bobby would say. And they would carefully put the elephant block on the very top. But Bob would sneeze and the tower would fall down. Bobby laughed. "Elephants always make you sneeze, Bob," Bobby would say. "We'll just have to try the next time," his grandfather would say. Then Bob would sit Bobby on his knee. "Tell me the story about how you taught me to walk," said Bobby. And his grandfather would tell how he held Bobby's hands and said, "Now one foot, now the other, and before you knew it." On Bobby's fifth birthday, Bob and he had a special day. They went to an amusement park, they rode a roller coaster, they ate hot dogs and ice cream. When it got dark, they watched the fireworks. On the way home, Bob told Bob stories. "Now tell me the story about how you taught me to walk," said Bobby, and Bob did. But not long after that birthday, Bob got very sick. Bobby came home from school one day, and his grandfather wasn't there. "Bob is in the hospital," said Dad. "He's had what is called a stroke." "I want to go see him," Bobby said. "You can't, honey," Mom said. "Right now, Bob is too sick to see anyone. He can't move his arms and legs, and he can't talk. The doctor isn't even sure if Bob knows who anyone is. We'll just have to wait and hope he gets better." Bobby didn't know what to do. He didn't want to eat. He had a hard time going to sleep at night. Bob just had to get better. Months and months went by. Bob was still in the hospital. Bobby missed him. Finally, one day, Dad said Bob was coming home. "Bob is still very sick," Dad said. "He can't move or talk. When he sees your mother and me, he still doesn't know who we are." "So don't be scared if he doesn't remember you." But Bobby was scared. His grandfather didn't remember him. He just lay in bed. When Dad carried him, Bob sat in a chair, but he didn't even talk or move. One day, Bob tried to say something to Bobby, but the sound that came out was awful. Bobby ran out of the room. "Bob sounded like a monster," Bobby cried. "He can't help it, Bobby," Mom said. So Bobby went back to the room where Bob was sitting. It looked like a tear was coming down Bob's face. "I didn't mean to run away, Bob. I was scared. I'm sorry," Bobby said. "Do you know who I am?" Bobby thought he saw Bob blink his eye. "Mom, Mom," Bobby called. "Bob knows who I am." "Oh, Bobby," Mom said, "you're just going to upset yourself. Bob doesn't recognize any of us." But Bobby ran to the front room under the stairs and took the blocks off the shelf and ran back to where Bob was sitting. Bob's mouth made a small smile. Bobby began to build the tower. Halfway, almost to the top, only one block left. "Okay, Bob," said Bobby. "Now the elephant block." And Bob made a strange noise. It sounded like a sneeze. The blocks fell down, and Bob smiled and moved his fingers up and down. Bobby laughed and laughed. Now he knew that Bob would get better. And Bob did. Slowly he began to talk a little. It sounded strange, but he could say Bobby just as clear as day. And when the weather got nice and warm, Dad carried Bob out to a chair set up on the lawn. Bobby sat with him. "Story," said Bob. So Bobby told him some stories. Then Bob stood up very slowly. "You, me, walk," said Bob. Bobby knew exactly what Bob wanted to do. He stood in front of Bob and let him lean on his shoulders. "Okay, Bob, now 1 foot." Bob moved 1 foot. "Now the other foot." Bob moved the other. By the end of the summer, Bob and Bobby could walk to the end of the lawn, and Bob could talk better and better each day. On Bobby's 6th birthday, Bobby got out the blocks. Slowly, he built up the tower. Only 1 block left. "Here, elephant block," said Bob. Bobby put it on top. Can you guess what happened?
What?
Bob sneezed. "Elephants always make you sneeze, Bob," said Bobby. "Now tell me some stories." Bob did. And then Bob said, "Tell story how you teach Bob to walk." "Well, Bob," said Bobby, "you leaned on my shoulders, and then I said, 'Now 1 foot, now the other.' And before you knew it..." And that's our story today. Thank you for listening. And can we have our lantern bearer for today, please? May the light and love of our chalice lead you today and every day. Please join in singing the children to their classrooms. The song is printed in your order of service, "For You Shall Go Out in Joy." Giving in the Free Church is an act of faith. We give in response to all the gifts we have been given. We give in gratitude. We give because love grows as it is shared. Let us further the reach of love in the world and give of our resources abundantly, believing in the possibility of a community and a world transformed by our care. The morning offering will now be given and received. Our thanks given for these gifts and received for the work of this community. So now is the time in our service when we share our joys and concerns. We do this by two ways, speaking them aloud and lighting candles. So would anyone who has a joy or concern to share, please raise your hand and the ushers will bring you a microphone.
This is Chris. Those of you who know me know that I celebrate the whole month of January for my birthday, but it's actually January 10th, and I would like three candles for my birthday, January 10th, Laura Levenhagen's birthday, January 10th, and Christy Ayler's birthday, January 10th.
Hi, this is Bev, and I'd like a candle of joy lit for my son Ryan, my older son, and his new wife Shirley. They just married in Panama where they live. She has two young children, so I have not only gained a daughter, but two grandchildren as well. And they're very happy, and I hope they continue that way forever. Thank you.
This is Mary. I'd just like to do a joy. My dear friend Amy, who was diagnosed with cancer on her 50th birthday, got very good news this December, and she appears to be clear after radiation and chemo. So I'm so relieved.
This is Carrie. Could you light a candle of concern just for anybody who's struggling with anxiety? I'm holding someone in my heart today who's really struggling with that.
This is Kirsten, a candle of support for the employees of DuPont who tomorrow, 1,700 of them will be laid off. And my son works for DuPont, and they have 15 minutes to find out their fate. I think he's going to be one of the few who does make it, but for the rest who have to find a new career choice, this is a hard time for them.
And we'll light one more candle for the joys and sorrows which we hold deeply, which have not been named here today.
Our first reading is One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these things will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch. And look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, more realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, a disaster. Here ends the first reading.
Please join me now in a few moments of silent thought, meditation, or the spirit of prayer.
Today's second reading is excerpted from Psychology Today. Why Do We Have an Obsession with Winning? By Ray Williams. America is obsessed with winning at everything, often at any cost. It translates from the war rooms to the athletic fields to the language of the business world in phrases such as dominating the opposition and destroying opponents. According to the World Value Survey, Americans' approval of competition is unmatched by any other industrialized country. Americans also believe more strongly in the fairness of unequal outcomes, rewarding those who try and succeed and leaving those who fall behind to their own devices. Recent research has shown a clear relationship between levels of happiness and competition. A comparative study of 42 nations around the world published in the Journal of Comparative Social Science found that happiness decreases as the level of competition increases in a given society. The argument is often made that intense competition builds character. Learning how to win and lose is supposed to toughen us and give us confidence. Yet, as anthropologist Jules Henry has said, a competitive culture endures by tearing people down. In his book, Winning: Reflections on an American Obsession, Francisco Duena argues that America's obsession with competition and winning reflects a social need to categorize people as winners or losers based on our belief in the concept of equal opportunities, as opposed to a social commitment to equal benefits for the good of all. Winning is also about being right. Victors are given the credence and respect to voice their views. Losers agonize and ruminate about their mistakes. Losers even question their identity and culture and character. Spectators who identify with the winners and losers can feel even more righteous, and this sometimes is taken to extremes. Duena says we have a tendency to use the outcomes of competitive events to generalize about the competitors, their behavior, their beliefs and knowledge, and apply it to all aspects of life. Whereas research shows that being successful or unsuccessful in one area of life does not transfer unnecessarily to other areas. A competitive mindset and focus on winning can introduce a continuous state of dissatisfaction with one's life. Like gambling in Vegas, the odds are against you. You will lose most of the time because you can't win all of the time. So every competition sets up the potential for humiliation, embarrassment, and demotivation if the aim is winning. And once you've tasted it, you need more. It's like an addiction. The pleasure effect of winning does not last. Unlike the satisfaction of having done the best that you can, which has been shown to be linked with emotional maturity and strong personal identity. Having a winning mindset has its advantages. It generates intensity, determination, and effort. But a competitive mindset has serious problems. The first is pitting America against the rest of the world, and Americans aggressively promoting the notion that they are the best. Alfie Kohn, author of No Contest, The Case Against Competition, argues that cooperation and collaboration, which do not focus on winners and losers, have been a more fundamental reflection of human activity throughout the time and cultures throughout the world. And competition in schools, sports, and the workplace, families, and among countries can be the one thing that divides, disrupts, and turns to negativity. The world now more than ever requires cooperation, not competition, to address our most pressing problems, economic woes, global warming, poverty, famine, crime, and many others. While we like to preach that competition brings people closer together, it is rarely the winning that does that. It is more often the personal journey, the shared experience, and compassion for failure that is stronger. An obsession with winning restrains people from engaging in a personal journey of self-knowledge and finding one's place in life as an entirely internal and personal process, not one that requires constant comparisons with others as a measure of self-worth. Winning is an outcome. When people become obsessed with outcomes, they can lose sight of the journey, lose sight of who they are and how they got there, and lose appreciation for the value of the people who don't win. Here ends the second reading. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing hymn number 83, Winds Be Still.
The art of losing isn't hard to master. You may, in fact, already be losing up to 9 things per day if you're similar to respondents in a 2012 survey conducted by a British insurance company. Cell phones, keys, and paperwork top the list. We're not in the habit of thinking positively about our losses, maybe other than the enjoyment of losing ourselves in a good book or some other favorite activity. Aside from the few things we wish we could lose, like weight, a bad cough, the attentions of a bully, loss feels like a hole, an emptiness. Loss is an undesirable subtraction of something from our lives or an absence of something we were never able to attain. Poet Naomi Shihab Nye writes, "Once a class of unruly students came into sudden clear focus when I entered their room and said simply, 'What have you lost? write it down. The lists were long and haunted. Freedom, memory, cats, great aunts, being little. I remember more people turning over their papers to write on the backs that day than ever before. Everyone had lost so much already. Their poems were thoughtful, poignant ruminations, by far the best descriptive and narrative writing in our time together. I was reminded of something a teacher told us once when I was in school. The things that cause you friction are the things from which you might make art. Surely losing is one of the most endemic frictions of our journey. Loss is inevitable, an everyday thing. Big losses, small losses. Some we move through and past quickly, others not so quickly. The longer you live, the more you lose. Objects, relationships, direction, abilities, hopes, dreams. Naomi Shihab Nye continues, is there anything good about losing? Does loss help us discover anything? Maybe sometimes we notice or take better care of what we still have momentarily. No matter how many things we've already lost, we don't necessarily find losing any easier to heal from or comprehend. The way we view our losses seems to have a lot to do not only with their scale and their degree of permanence, but with our assessment of how much control we did or didn't have over losing whatever we lost. And being culturally conditioned to a competitive mindset as we are might lead us to believe we have more control over the circumstances of our losses than we actually do. When we divide the world into winners and losers, we constantly rank ourselves against each other as well as against what we believe is possible. Everybody knows nobody can win all the time. You win some, you lose some. But we behave as if everything we want is ultimately winnable. It's all about strategy. You have to figure out or understand the rules and then work them to your own gain, maybe bending them a little here and there. How far are you willing to go to get something you really want to win? Hand in hand with a competitive mindset is a scarcity mindset. There's only one gold medal in every event. After all, resources are scarce. Praise and recognition are scarce. Even time is scarce. Get your share, or better yet, win over others and ensure a bigger share. It seems that we actually get a better ego buzz that way. A Carnegie Mellon and Harvard study found that our happiness increases when we get a raise and someone else doesn't, but not when everyone's income is increased. We like to think that our wins are always the result of individual effort. Yet we know that most societies, including ours, at one time or another, have rigged the game so that certain people are born losers. By being female, by being the wrong color, being the wrong sexual orientation, or inheriting the wrong religion. People automatically lose if they turn out the wrong weight or the wrong height or speak with the wrong accent. Anyone who benefits from the rigged game comes to feel entitled to their safety and security, their winner-take-all rewards. If losers start to raise questions about rules, winners cling harder to their advantages, sometimes moving the finish line, sometimes resorting to dishonesty, aggression, or violence. We see this play out not just in attempts to literally destroy imagined opponents, as in mass shootings or police brutality, but in day-to-day petty competitions in workplaces, on the freeways, in parking lots and grocery lines where people cut each other off and jockey for position as if everything is a race and their lives depend on winning. We do not want to come in last at anything. Sometimes we get mindlessly caught up in these meaningless contests, even when they go contrary to what we think of as our deeply held values. I know I do. Consider the possibility that our obsession with winning causes us to generalize so far that we equate almost every kind of loss with failure, even ones that are the result of natural cycles and processes. Take getting older. Once people are past a certain age, bodily changes are described almost exclusively in terms of loss. You lose your hair, your skin tone, your eyesight, your hearing, your coordination, your memory, the list goes on. What does it add up to? Nothing but a failure to be young, or to at least appear young. Rarely does anyone talk about human development in terms of loss when it comes to children. But if you think about language development, when infants start to babble, they make every sound humanly possible. But in the course of focusing exclusively on the language of their parents or primary caregivers, long before they reach adulthood, children eventually lose the ability to trill their tongues and make clicks and all those other things that you find in languages around the world that we can't do. No one really considers this a failure of any kind, though. It's just the way we think. What if we thought differently and refused to let loss define us? This is not to deny decay and death, because we're already doing that anyway. For those who can afford it, there are plenty of ways to maintain the illusion of youth more or less indefinitely. And I can't recall who said this, but it stuck with me ever since I heard it. Americans think death is optional. And certainly we are willing to go to great medical lengths to try and at least cheat death, even if it's the one thing we really can't win over. What's it all about? First, we just don't like how it feels to lose. So we do all kinds of seemingly irrational and illogical things to avoid it. This phenomenon is known as loss aversion in economics and decision theory. So most studies pertaining to loss aversion suggest that losses are twice as powerful psychologically as gains. This information is typically applied in marketing, but it might possibly serve us in understanding our motivations in other areas also. And then there's the fact that we don't get good training in how to handle our losses. The only thing worse than a loser, of course, is a sore loser, a whiner. We learn early to hush up when we fail because nobody likes a poor sport or a crybaby. We learn early to stifle our feelings, even though they might be an entirely appropriate response to the situation. Sadness is a normal reaction to any kind of loss. But we are encouraged to get past sadness as soon as possible, even when you've suffered some major life catastrophe. Other people only have so much tolerance for your grief before they start to send message indicating that you should get over it and move on. We are as profoundly uncomfortable with other people's losses as we are with our own. And while it's true that some people get stuck in a victim mentality about their losses and try ineffectively to use them as a way to connect with or emotionally manipulate others, most of us eventually turn our feelings inward and limp along, doing the best we can by ourselves. Due to lack of instruction and practice, we are not skilled at sitting with our sadness long enough to learn what it has to teach us. We worry that it's taking too long, so we rush to resolve it, or at least give the appearance of having resolved it. This rush to resolve our discomfort can lead us straight to blame. We blame others for getting in our way, or we blame ourselves for not controlling the situation the way we think we should have. If only someone or something had been different, we could have won. We could have prevented ourselves from losing. Ellen Langer, psychologist and author of several books about mindfulness, tells this story in an episode of Public Radio's On Being program. She says, "Many years ago, I had a major fire that destroyed 80% of what I owned. And when I called the insurance company and they came over the next day, the insurance agent said to me that this was the first call he'd ever had where the damage was worse than the call. I thought, well, gee, you know, it's already taken my stuff. Why give it my soul? Why pay twice?" Which is what people so often do. Something happens, you have that loss, and then you're going to now throw all your emotional energy at it. And so you're doubling up on the negativity. So if we go back to the study about losing track of cell phones and keys and paperwork, on the surface that seems like a pretty small problem because we usually locate those things again unless, you know, you put your cell phone on your car and drive away or something like that. Don't realize it for 10 miles. But haven't you ever worked yourself into a frenzy while searching for those things or beaten yourself up for your failing memory or for wasting time by not being more organized. Our self-recrimination in the face of bigger losses is proportional. If only I had taken a different route. If only I hadn't said that. If only I'd been a better parent or a better friend. If only. And if we allow ourselves to start comparing our suffering with the suffering of others, it can become another contest in and of itself, laden with self-judgment. We don't just pay twice for our losses, we pay over and over. We go round and round in our heads with these stories, promising ourselves we'll try harder, plotting ways to prove we're not as bad of a loser as we might look or feel, all in an attempt to keep at arm's length the other feeling associated with loss and failure, the one that feels even worse than sorrow or grief, shame. Over the past decade or so, social scientist Brené Brown has done extensive research on shame and vulnerability. In a culture that celebrates winning as a show of worthiness and strength, vulnerability is seen as a weakness, the character trait of a loser. Brené Brown's findings indicate otherwise. She says, "I define vulnerability as uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. Vulnerability is not weakness because the uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure we face every day are not optional. Our only choice is a question of engagement." Engagement takes courage. The courage to question your internal narrative, to quote from Brené Brown again, to peel away layer after layer of beliefs, behaviors, and assumptions, and rigorously hold yourself accountable to life. Engagement is definitely not for weaklings. When we engage with life, we stumble and fall and pick ourselves up again, time after time, and we do it not because it will eventually lead to any kind of victory, but because it will enable us to live wholehearted lives full of meaningful connections with the people around us. To not engage with life and move through our failures to greater self-understanding is the real loss. Parker Palmer, a Quaker teacher and author, agrees. He writes, "Facing into failure can help vaporize the illusions that keep me from seeing reality. When I succeed at something, I don't spend much time wondering what I might learn from it. Instead, I congratulate myself on how clever I am, thus inflating my ego's favorite illusion. Failure gives me a chance to touch hard truths about myself and my relation to the world that I evade when I'm basking in the glow of success and the illusion it breeds." Brené Brown continues, "The level to which we protect ourselves from being vulnerable is a measure of our fear and disconnection. When we feel good about the choices we're making, and when we're engaging with the world from a place of worthiness rather than scarcity, we feel no need to judge and attack. In other words, we feel no need to compete with other people for our sense of self-worth. We feel no need to win." Or as Alfie Cohn, who was quoted in the second reading today, says, "The real alternative to being number one is not being number two, but being psychologically free enough to dispense with rankings altogether." This idea tends to make us uncomfortable. If we don't strive to win at something, how will we ever achieve anything? How will we ever get anywhere in life? Won't we become passive and self-effacing? Doesn't it mean we won't ever work to challenge injustices or make positive changes in the world? In his writings, Alfie Cohn cites study after study showing that children's achievement levels are actually superior when they cooperate versus compete, and other studies which show that scientists, business people, academics, pilots, and experts in other professions report that personal challenge meant more to them than achievement through competition. The research of Cohn and Brown and others contradicts conventional thinking about how we motivate ourselves to do our best and what, in the long run, will actually make us happy. Viewing life in terms of winning and losing sets up a dualism. Practicing the art of losing requires us to embrace a paradox. The saying, "You have to lose yourself in order to find yourself," sounds like a cliche, but it's been around for centuries as a serious spiritual concept. Even if you restate it as you need to let yourself lose in order to win, the general meaning doesn't alter much. Either way, like so many spiritual concepts, we don't find it easy to comprehend with our intellects, probably because it's not meant to be understood that way. The Sufi mystic Rumi writes, "When you lose all sense of self, the bonds of a thousand chains will vanish. Lose yourself completely. Return to the root of your own soul." When we resist the ego-gratifying seduction of identifying as a winner, we free ourselves. We open ourselves to richer, deeper lives. Learning how to sit still with our feelings about loss and failure makes us better able to sit with others through their losses and witness to their suffering. It makes us better partners, better leaders, better parents, and better friends. It makes us more compassionate, more willing to acknowledge when we need a helping hand, and more willing to offer the same to someone who is being treated unfairly or someone who has stumbled and fallen. It makes us braver. So your cell phone, your keys, the paperwork, that's just the beginning. Go ahead. Lose farther and faster. Working with instead of against each other, we can handle just about any disaster.
I think we have time for a polylog if you want a polylog.
Yeah.
Wasn't sure if we would or not, how it would turn out. If anybody has anything they want to share on the subject, we have a couple minutes.
Hi, I'm Barb. Boy, this is my subject. I feel like a professional loser a lot of times in my life. And yet, as so eloquently expressed by you, Christy, the things that we lose, the ways in which we lose, the things that we lose, the process of losing is almost always our best teacher. And the thing about accepting loss is that you have to back off your ego a little bit, and that is so hard. But, I came here today grateful to be here, grateful to see everybody, and grateful to end my season of losing, because every hot Christmas holiday, I set myself up for failure. I think I'm going to achieve perfection this year, get everything right, make everyone happy, and do all the things I'm supposed to do, and I never do. I don't think any of us do. So thank you so much for these words of wisdom.
Hi, this is Gus. Thank you, Christy, very much for that. I agree with Barb. This topic is right on the mark for a lot of us here. One of the things that I've always tried to avoid in my life is obviously pain, physical pain, that is to say, and also the thought that I could be shamed or embarrassed in public. I don't know why I've got that fear, but I've discovered that the only way I've been able to deal with physical pain that there's nothing I can do about, and those moments which are always there, some lurking behind a curtain somewhere where they're going to pop out and result in embarrassment in public and the shame that comes with that, is to remember that the shame and pain ground my feet. They remind me that my feet are planted firmly on an earth that is physical, and my body, which experiences the pain, is a physical thing, and it gets me out of my head. I found that to be very therapeutic. So I appreciate what you're saying, and one can look at pain and losing as being therapy to remind us that the winning and the success in life is a search for finality and a search for meaning and a conclusion that is never there.
Search for like a certain outcome.
And this is Jim. Christy, thank you. Mm-hmm. Right. Lots of good lessons in that service. And your reading by Parker Palmer, who is one of my favorite spiritual authors, reminded me of one of my favorite cliches, which is, my ego is not my amigo.
Hi, this is Mary. It's almost like pointing out the air we breathe. Like, you just can't even appreciate even the level of pervasiveness of the win-loss mindset and the competition mindset. In higher ed and in engineering in particular, everything is a competition. Everything. From an internship to grades to design competitions. That's the format of everything. And I don't know how to, we try to even talk to people about a more collaborative type of achievement. And it's like you can't even define what that would look like.
It's like speaking a different
language
to people.
Yeah, it's like a different language. And I don't know, when I'm immersed in this sea and this is how we train mm-hmm. our generations. I don't know what, how any kind of alternative framework would get built. Mm-hmm. I feel a little discouraged sometimes.
At least for me, like when I'm in a competitive situation, I don't like to compete. A lot of people do like to compete. They like that thrill or whatever, but I don't. And you get in a situation where other people are competing and you're not competing, people don't know what to make of you. But it is possible to just do your best and, to deal with it on a personal level. I don't know how you'd handle it if you're, I don't know, it depends, I guess it depends on what you view the stakes as being, for me.
This is Dan.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that one of the things I got out of it is, instead of looking at this as a personal journey to accept loss and therapeutic or learn from it, it reminds me to, give other people space when they deal with loss, because it's real and it's hard. And it's hard in the moment to see it as a lesson or a therapy. It's more just, pain and suffering and sadness, depending on what it is. So I think a good message is, don't judge, give people space, give them time, and remember when you've lost something that it's not at that moment a therapy or a lesson. It's just a loss.
Hi, I'm Emily. I've heard a lot of really good things that I can relate to. The last two comments, the one about how do we deal with this society that's so competitive, and I think, like, as far as our children and teaching others, is just to let people feel what they feel. You don't always have to be happy. You don't always have to be, like, successful in the quotation marks, what is success? Sadness is a emotion too that can be embraced, and we all grieve and go through our things differently, and I think acceptance of that, of not always being the happy person or the positive emotions, just to embrace those difficult emotions too as part of life.
Good morning, I'm Barbara. one of the things was this competition everywhere you go, and especially high school, college. You know, when I see my grandchildren, we've had many talks, and I think they're beginning to realize that if it's a win, you really, if you just win, you don't learn. Where's your real learning? Where does your real growth come in? And they're beginning to understand that it's the process, and that from losing, they're really, in the end, growing much more and learning much more.
Hi, I'm Terry, and I was raised Jewish, and when Rosh Hashanah comes, which is the new year, we have a week to think about all of the things that we've done in the past year that we would like to make amends for, and turn those things over so that you can be welcomed for another year into the book of life. That's the Jewish. So all of those things that you did wrong, or you feel ashamed of, or you made mistakes, basically you strip yourselves of those things. You fast for a day and think about it all day long. In my life now, I think about the things that are the hardest for me to lose are things like self-judgment and judgment of others, and self-righteousness and grandiosity, all of those things that make me think that I'm right. And that's a way of thinking that I can win, by thinking I'm right. And losing those things, at first, it feels like, well, what's going to be left of me if I let go of those things? You know, who am I really going to be without all of those, like my bossiness or my thinking that I am in control of anything? So those are the things that I want to lose, but they're very hard to lose because of how ingrained they are, and also how, I don't know, maybe I identify myself with some of those things. So very interesting. Thank you.
I think, yeah, we have time maybe for one more. Are there two people who have comments or one? If they're brief, we could probably do two.
A couple of thoughts. My son was young. I was a Cub Scout leader, and we always have, every year we'd have the Pinewood Derbies, and which is always, you know, fun making them. But inevitably, you know, it was a competition, and we had prizes, you know, trophies maybe for the first three, but there were always boys crying, and that was, I don't know, we tried to work and try to talk to them ahead of time and get them not to be so competitive, but we were perpetuating it, and so that there was a lot of frustration with that. And kind of the opposite of that, too, is I don't know if I fully agree with, you know, the idea that everybody's a winner, and my son Paul has shelves full of trophies of every event he participated in. Everybody gets a medal, everybody gets a trophy, right. And there's so many that do you have to win? I mean, can you just participate? You know,
we try to avert the pain of losing by giving everyone a prize, but then that's sort of meaningless because then you just have a thing for competing, not the reward of participating or anything else you might have gotten out of it. Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of an illusion in that when you go into the real world, mm-hmm. you don't necessarily everybody get a prize, or that you personally always get the
winner. Well, you don't want anyone else to get a prize because you feel better if you get one and no one else gets one. See, that's what the research shows.
This is Al. Hopefully a couple of brief, quick thoughts. So one, you know, there are parts of the society that grew up knowing they're losers. I speak of Cubby fans and And in my history, Red Sox into the recent
underdogs.
Years. So. But anyhow, I think listening to how you give these things up, I've had a path of trying to get my ego out of the way pretty seriously for the past couple of years, and a meditative practice does seem to help you identify those things that trigger to reach back to peeling of the onion that you talked about a little bit, and letting the ego not continue to show you that same reality movie over and over in your head. So there's that. The last thing I guess I'm pleased with is knowing that I'm a loser, appreciating that people can tell me I'm a loser and go, thank you. That's a good thing.
Yeah, that's a good note to end on. Thanks, everybody.
As we close the circle of worship, we extinguish our chalice in hope that each of us has found here what we needed this day. May the light of this flame carry us outward into the world with renewed spirit. Please rise, embody your spirit, and join in singing hymn number 1021 in the teal book, Lean on Me.
Thank you.
Sometimes the vision we share for compassion and community is bigger than our actual hearts. Often our hopes for a just society that is both free and responsible exceeds what we actually do to create it. But may we never let our failing and floundering keep us from seeking again and again to live out in concrete deeds the hopes and dreams of our collective heart. Go in peace.